Our world has become complex and disruptive, and leading teams and organizations takes courage, determination, and skill. This podcast connects you to some of the great leaders to find out just how they do it. You're listening to Russell Boyce and Daryl Crook in conversation with standout leadership in a world of disruption.
Welcome, listeners, to this next edition of the podcast, Leadership in a Disruptive World. Today, we have the wonderful opportunity to chat and learn from the insights of Dr. Sarah Pearson. I've known Sarah for quite a while now in various capacities. She's got a very, very interesting and quite impressive list of things that she's been up to over the course of her career, from a PhD at Oxford through to leading the innovation thinking of a number of organisations, including the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Australia. She's a serial board member. For example, she's part of the Council of the Australian National University. She's a board director on a number of commercial organisations. And she's now a member of Australia's Foreign Investment Review Board. If you put all that together, she's got a significant amount of experience in the industry world, in the world of research and innovation. She's passionate about STEM, she's passionate about young people, and she's passionate about leadership. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Russell. Lovely to chat with you.
Sarah, let's get started on this conversation. We always start the same way. Please tell us about yourself just briefly so that our listeners have a bit more of an understanding of you, where you come from, and the context in which you've pursued leadership so that it makes sense what this conversation that will unfold over the next half an hour or so, what it all means.
Thank you. Thanks, Russell and Daryl. Well, the first thing I'd say is as a young person, I didn't seek leadership. In fact, I was quite a reluctant leader as a young person and didn't even see myself as a leader because I didn't have any role models that looked or sounded or acted like me who were in leadership. So it was a bit of a surprise to me. I think the first time that I realized that I was seen as a leader was actually when I was at McKinsey, and we were doing some psychological, wasn't leadership work, it was collaborative teamworking work. And it's pretty scary because you're in these teams and it's all competitive and everyone's competing, but you're trying to be a team. Anyway, we were in two separate teams who were competing against one another to do this particular activity. We basically had to get everybody through holes in these little rope things. Anyway, our team were failing really badly. And so they stopped the competition and took us all aside. And they took the leader aside and said, "I'm sorry, but you can't be the leader anymore. We need a different leader." So there was they had about four of us in this little circle saying, "Well, one of you's got to be the leader." And we're all going, "Not me, not me." That's way too frightening. But everybody else stepped backwards and I got left there, which is sort of, I think, is a good indication of the sort of leader I am, is when I see something that needs to be done, I will actually step up and do it. I don't necessarily go, "I'm going to be a leader." I go, "There's something here that needs to be done and nobody else is stepping up to do it. So I'll step into the leadership role." And so I did. I stepped into the leadership role and they called me out as, you know, leadership material. And that was the first time anyone had ever said to me, "Sarah, you've got leadership characteristics." So like I said, I've done leadership stuff as a young girl, but I'd never thought myself as a leader. So that was the first real sort of someone actually saying, "Yes, you're a leader." And then since then, it's been the same. It's really been when I see something that needs to be done, and there's a gap and no one's filling it and someone's got to step out there and lead people along, then I will step in and do that. I think a classic example, and the time that I really got to understand my leadership style, was when I helped set up the Canberra Innovation Network. So that was about leading an economy, leading a community, drawing a community together, so being a collective leader. And I really did, I got to know myself as a leader a lot more then, which was a bit late in life. I had all sorts of other leadership roles before then, but it was then that I really understood the sort of leader I was, which is someone, like I say, who sees a gap, sees something that needs to be done. I'm passionate and driven about making a difference in whatever it is that needs to be done. And then I'll draw people in. I love inspiring people. I love empowering people and seeing how much you can achieve collectively rather than just on your own. And then since, like I say, I've had all sorts of leadership positions, but that was a really defining one for me in terms of the sort of leader that I am.
So you're a servant leader, clearly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And you know, the first time I saw a servant leader was actually at Cadbury. I had left academia and the world of physics and research to go to the commercial world as global head of open innovation at Cadbury. And I was, that was a little bit scary too, because not because I was moving into a whole other world, that was quite exciting and interesting, but I was actually going to be working with a lot of women. Now, as a physicist, it's always been men, and I knew how men led, but I had no idea how women were going to lead. Anyway, there was a lot of women I worked with, and the person I reported to directly was actually on the science and technology leadership team for Cadbury, so a global leadership role. So she was someone really great to learn from. Anyway, one night I was there late. I don't know, 7 o'clock at night or something, and most of the lights have gone out, but I need to go to the kitchen, get a drink. Off I go to the kitchen, and who's in the kitchen but my boss? And she was stacking the dishwasher. And I thought, wow, you know, leadership is not hierarchical. Leadership is actually being a human and working with the humans around you to get the things done that need to get done. And so it's really interesting you say that servant leader, you give it that title, Russell. I've mentioned it a number of times in my talks, and some people don't like it because they think women always think they should be servants. But I think it's a beautiful role that you can take as a leader, where you're not hierarchical. You're someone that draws everybody in. When you see there's a gap, you help fill it. Nothing's too low for you. Nothing's too high for you. At the end of the day, you're still the one that has to make the final decisions on the decisions that nobody else wants to make. Like, oh my God, I better stack the dishwasher tonight.
Sarah and Daryl here, the examples that you're giving there at the moment, it's got me thinking, and I'd be keen to get your views on this. We've seen decades, in fact, generations of layered approaches to management and the hierarchical models and the so-called military models of the past, and yet we are seeing change happening all around us from those more traditional hierarchical views of what leadership was. As a management consultant myself, I will often make the statement that leadership's more a set of attitudes and behaviours these days rather than a position or title. And if we follow that line of thinking, when we can certainly talk about a shared leadership model, if there are 1,000 people in the organization, then if leadership is really a set of attitudes and behaviors, we can have 1,000 leaders in that organization. The ability to think strategically, the ability to harness people around you and to build teamwork, the ability to model what a good culture looks like. And so the list of attitudes and behaviors goes on. The trick is, if you get yourself into an executive role in that business, can you demonstrate the leadership attitudes and behaviors? And so you get that double bonus of having the authority, if you like, in decision making, but also clearly demonstrating leadership attitudes and behaviors, hence stacking the dishwasher when it needs to be, and not sort of looking around for someone to tell to go and do it for you. So you've moved around a fair bit and you've got a very impressive background. Can you just unpick this notion of leadership being a set of attitudes and behaviors and therefore the shared leadership model, and in fact, moving around where people will step in and step out when required, if it requires someone to step in and step up in a situation, in a project, in a team activity where others may be reluctant to do so. Can you just unpack your thoughts on that for me?
Yes, I will. I'd love to, Daryl. I'm actually going to start with when I first became a tenured physics academic. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I go in front of all these young kids. I'm going to have to teach them everything because the situation was that everybody else had gone. So I was teaching everything. And how on earth am I going to do that? And I remember reaching out to a colleague who'd actually helped me get the job. And I said to him, I'm just a bit concerned here because I don't know everything. I don't know how am I going to cope with this? And he said, well, Sarah, you're not supposed to know everything. You don't need to know everything. No one can know everything. And that was the first, you know, to that cultural and attitude piece. That was the first piece which really meant, said to me, you know what, in this world, don't panic about thinking you've got to know everything. There's lots of people you can work with who can know bits and pieces of the puzzle that you can draw together, and collectively you will be able to achieve it. So that's the first piece of that puzzle. The second piece of that puzzle is actually remembering that we're all humans. I remember at Cadbury, I got given a team. And I find it harder when you're given a team. I find it much easier to build a team. You know, you can pick the sorts of people that can form that team. But anyway, I had to work with the team. They were great. They were a great team. But one example is this: one of the fellows was actually close to retirement. And I thought, and he really wasn't as interested and passionate as committed to open innovation as I was. And I found that challenging. So then what I realized was actually he's got things he enjoys. What he really enjoyed was actually working with our supply chain. He'd spent his whole lifetime working with the suppliers. And so I found a way to get him passionate and excited and engaged so that he could actually generate his own energy and he could do much more than I could even imagine that he could have done. So by finding his passion and his energy, I managed to help him to generate his own energy and do more. So that was a real lesson in terms of not everybody has to be the same. You just got to find what it is that really excites and inspires people to do more. The other lesson, this is another one at Cabby, another lesson I learned was that people will be with you for a while, but they won't be with you forever, and that's fine. You know, your job, or my job, I felt as a leader, was to help to grow these people that were in my team and I was responsible for. And so there was one young woman, for instance, who it was clear that she had ambition for other things, and she wanted to work in the commercial part of the business, not just the innovation and the research part. So the lesson I learned there was, okay, I will work with her to develop her. And that might mean that she goes off and does 6 months with the commercial guys and gals, which actually is good for my team because we need to be connected to those commercial people. But it'd be really good for her to understand if that's a career that she wants. So that was another lesson learned, which was, well, actually, you just need to develop people in your team. Some of that will be really useful for the work that you're doing. Some of it will be useful for them. But still, it means they're empowered and inspired and energetic, they can get on and deliver more. Another thing I learned when I was CEO at the Canberra Innovation Network was just how much influence you have by who you are as a leader. I looked, you know, we built the team from nothing. So there were two of us one day a week where we built up to, I don't know, I think they've got probably 20 people in the team now, but when I left, there was something like 15. So we built up that team and we built up all the work that we did, all the services we delivered, all the culture that went throughout the whole community. And I looked at the team and I realized that what I was doing was impacting who they were and how they were turning up to work, which then had an impact on the whole community and the ecosystem. And it had never struck me until then, oh my God, the people that you have, not just myself, but the people ahead of my leadership team, makes a big difference how they turn up and how they speak, how they act, how they look after people, how they empower people to, you know, if people come along and say, hey, I've got three 3D printers. I want to do something with them. I want to put them somewhere. And we can say, well, we've got a room. Why don't you set up a 3D printing entity? And then we can help everybody in the community. And suddenly you've got stuff happening that would never have happened before. But that was because of this can-do culture and attitude that we set from the top. So it attracts people to do more. So I learned those things about collective leadership. I did also learn that however collective you are, as a leader, as the CEO, for instance, it's still quite a lonely journey. You're still the person that has to make the difficult decisions. And there's still responsibility on you to make all those final decisions and to guide and to inspire and do all those things. So it is still quite lonely. And I'll never forget my first CEO role, rocking up to ANU Enterprise, looking at this big building that I was now responsible for and this 100 staff and all the rest of them going, oh my God, I've got to bring in money so these people can all pay their mortgage. You know? So there's no escape. How, as collective as you want to be, you've still got a lot of, I believe, you've still got a lot of responsibility as the leader.
Sarah, that rings so true to me. As you know from conversations that you and I have had, I've just left a long, long career in the university sector, and in particular, a decade building a space program, which meant building a group of people. And one of the things that was said to me recently was, Russ, thanks for shielding us. Thanks for being that lonely person at the top, providing the top level cover for us and looking after us as people and keeping the stuff we just didn't have time to deal with away from our door. And it is lonely when you're doing that.
Yes,
absolutely.
It is lonely. Yeah. And but that's where, if you can find other lonely people in positions of leadership to help. I was also very lucky because as a CEO, I had a board and I had a chair of the board. And that's a really, from my perspective, that's a really important relationship. I mean, you're still alone because you're still the CEO and the chair can kick you out at any time. But I think that's a good one to lean on. And certainly in my board positions, that's something I try to do in terms of helping the CEO to not feel quite so lonely.
Sarah, can I just pick up on a couple of comments there? The notion of, and we've often heard with senior executives, particularly, it's lonely at the top, and the CEOs that I coach around Australia, that's a common theme that they will talk about, which begs the question, or a series of questions: where do you find your support, your confidant, your mentor, your independent, objective conscience, and who is that person, or perhaps those people? And a second question is the notion around, particularly for senior leaders, that you counter the lonely at the top by building a very strong leadership team around you. And while the final decision is often on your desk, it's the leadership team that is running the organization as such. And so you happen to be the team leader of that team. So two questions there. One is your personal support in that lonely at the top notion. And the second question, could you comment on your experience, your knowledge, your insight into the efficacy of building that leadership team around you?
So firstly, in terms of the loneliness, I mean, if you're fortunate, as I have been, to have a very supportive partner, you've got someone in your life that they don't necessarily, you know, my partner doesn't, has never worked in my field or my area, has never been never been the sort of leader that I have, led in different ways. But still, having someone human who you trust and you know who believes in you, that can really help, because it can also be, at times, can be, as a leader, it can be quite challenging to maintain your own self-esteem. So having someone who can help you with that in your own personal life is really, really good. I didn't make enough of networks of others who were CEOs. I wish I had. If I wanted to give any lessons, it would be to find those networks of people in leadership that you can trust. But something I did do is I've always had a portfolio of stuff going on. So even when I was a CEO, I was on boards and committees and panels and goodness only knows whatever else. So that there's always somewhere in your life where things are going really well. So that if things aren't going so well in one of them, then you're bolstered up by the others. So I would say, you know, for me, having that portfolio has been really good. The other thing that's been really important to me to maintain my energy is to be leading in things that I feel very strongly about, that I want to drive and create change and impact. And so then it doesn't matter what's going on. You can feel as lonely as you like. It doesn't really matter, because your focus, or my focus, has always been, what change am I trying to drive? What impact am I trying to drive? And that's what energizes me. The loneliness bit is just it is a bit lonely here, isn't it? It never lasts long, because I'm so focused on what I'm trying to, the change I'm trying to drive. So then to your next one around teams, and you're absolutely spot on. I built in the roles where I had teams that I could build. I built fantastic leadership teams that were really great friends. We were really close. We trusted one another implicitly. I knew that they had, you know, really great skills, and I'd let them fly. And we had a really brilliant collaborative relationship, and there was no hierarchy amongst us as a leadership team. And so from that perspective, we were very, very much together and doing the drive, and they were passionate about the change they wanted to drive too. So we were very much working together with that.
So Sarah, you've talked about being lonely at the top or being lonely as a leader, but if you're passionate about what you're doing, then you know that's okay. Well, let's notch it up one or two levels. What happens when crisis hits? What happens when the team or the organization that you're leading is facing existential threat or some other form of disruption? What do you do? How do you, as a leader, respond to that?
So I'll give you a classic example. I'd been at my first CEO role at ANU Enterprise. I'd been in the role a week, and we had to put in a whole load of applications into government to get onto government panels on our consulting business. And we spent, and then we spent the next few weeks getting that all ready. And 2 days before the due date, we started uploading everything, thinking 2 days, that's great, we have plenty of time. Anyway, it turns out everybody else was uploading all the things 2 days before, and the whole system crashed. And at which point I'm thinking, okay, I'm now in the situation where ANU will not be on any panels for any consulting work that we've been, you know, doing quite well out of the last, I don't know how many years. Shivers, what am I going to do? And so I think the first thing you learn to do there is you dig really deep inside. you know, you dig deep out down inside and go, okay, well, we just have to do something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to have to do something. So you think deep inside, what am I going to do? And then you start to think, okay, well, who do I lean on? Who do I talk to? Who can I collaborate with this to get us out of this hole? So the first thing was, well, I have to have open communication with my chair, and I have to have open communication with ANU to explain what's happening. And so that was the first thing I did, which is pretty challenging when it's such an existential threat. And you've only been there a few weeks. So I just, you know, spoke with ANU and said, this is what's happened. This is the situation we're in. And I was very fortunate that they were very supportive. And then, of course, the next thing you do is you go, okay, well, what's my next step I do in terms of sorting this out? What do you call up the government? You say, well, look, this is the situation we're in. Unfortunately, they realised that everybody had been in the same situation. So they opened up the portal and everybody else, you know, we all got to put our applications in. But it was incredibly scary for a while. So the first thing I said, like I said, dig deep inside, right, what have I got to do? Secondly, be open with your communication so it's really clear what's actually happening so that everybody knows how bad the situation is and you're not alone on this and not thinking that you need to solve it on your own. Find some people to help you solve it and then, go ahead and get the team to solve it, which they did.
Sarah, you mentioned a couple of times there the relationship between the CEO and the chair, and I really want to hit that with a highlighter as well. It's so critical. Often when I see a CEO derail, it's because they haven't built that relationship with the chair and or the board, and or they haven't built that team around them well enough. And so, you know, you've hit some of those classic derailers there that other CEOs have learned the hard way. Can I ask you the question around, you know, Russell was just saying, you know, what happens when things hit the fan and the crisis? What do you do then? For our listeners, before I go on, I noticed you said ANU, that you're talking about Australian National University there. And yes. For our listeners around the world, they'll probably say, oh, is that what ANU stands for? Sarah, can you just spend a moment talking about your personal resilience under pressure? How do you find what are your strategies that you use to keep the strength, keep the focus, keep your own mental health and physical health in check?
Well, firstly, I think, as I mentioned earlier on, one of the key things for me is if you're leading to do something you really believe in. And then because it's all about energy. It's not all about energy, but energy is absolutely key. At least that's what I've found. And I get energy from having an impact. So long as I'm leading where there's an impact that's happening and I'm generating an impact, then I can generate energy and that keeps my resilience. So things could be going badly, but you've still got the resilience because you know where you're aiming for. The second thing I'd say is I don't do no. there isn't a no. There's got to be a yes somehow. And there has to be a yes using some route. I mean, and a classic example would be at Cadbury. I really felt strongly that we needed an innovation strategy. So every 6 months, the new product development team would be racing around going, my God, we've got to launch something new. What are we going to do? Right, let's put a biscuit in it. And I thought we could do better than that. So, but I wasn't getting very far for a while. I knew the new product development team would be really keen to get a strategy so they didn't have to come back every 6 months. But I was getting pushback from others. So I found different ways of doing it. So it actually took me 6 months, but I went to each one of the category heads and tried to persuade them to do an innovation strategy. And that set up a little competition amongst them. and so then one of them was the first out of the rank, and then they did one. And before you know it, everybody else was going to do one as well. So I learned you might face no to start with, but find different ways of getting into to yes. It could be through different routes, through different ways of doing things, through different people. So I found that's helped me with my resilience, is to just not take no and just keep looking for a new way to get to yes and get to the outcome and the impact that you want to be driving. And then the last thing I'd say is have a bit of a life. So back in the day, I mean, nowadays I work 7 days a week, but I have some days off because I've got this portfolio. But back in the day when I had the week job, I used to make sure that I would not work most weekends. And I'm an outdoors person, so I love the outdoors. I have horses. I love riding. So that was my way of getting my downtime, my energy back, my relaxation and grounding, if you like. And that was really helpful for me.
Finding your therapy, I will often ask a CEO, you know, what is your therapy? And for many, they have realized over time that it cannot be found in the bottom of a bottle. It must be found through sleep, through exercise, through a hobby, through interest, through relationships. And so horses for you is part of your therapy, is it?
Yes, it was, absolutely, and still is. it really helps to get my energies back to where they need to be, and also my peace back to where it needs to be. It was interesting, someone once said to me, and this is related to this from an energy perspective, they said, okay, thinking about what you want to do with your life and your next career, look at your energy during the day and see where your energy gets stronger and where your energy gets weaker. So from a resilience perspective, that's another piece that I found really useful, which is, okay, follow the things where it generates energy in you, so then you can actually do even more.
Yeah, knowing your own rhythm of your own body and using that rhythm during the day and putting some of those harder decisions where possible when you've got the highest part of your rhythm for the day and not necessarily when you've got the lowest part of your rhythm.
Yes, and also looking at what types of activity could generate energy any time of the day. Like if I'm doing strategy, I can do that any time of the day. Or if I'm trying to be visionary and dream, you know, that's going to be any time of the day. But if I've got to deal with an HR issue, then that's not going to be giving me energy.
Good point.
Sarah, let's talk about that a little bit more. And just a few minutes ago, you were talking about, like, you won't accept a no. There's always a way. But then you proceeded from there to talk about, you know, trying this idea and that idea. So you were effectively, you were brainstorming, you were ideating, you were horizon scanning. That's very, very strategic levels of leadership. And then you've just said to us that doing the things that strategic leadership requires, the vision and the strategic thinking, that energizes you. So clearly that comes naturally to you. It doesn't come naturally to all leaders. Have you found that there are leaders out there that really, you know, they'd prefer just to be down in the spreadsheet or in the tactical level? And if that's the case, what would you say to them? But also, how do you, as the visionary leader, deal with them? Or there can be challenges there.
I did experience once being on a board where, actually it's been on two boards, where the chair has not been strategic or visionary. And that's been incredibly frustrating as someone who is strategic and visionary. In one of those situations, there were a number of us on the board who recognized that the chair didn't like strategy, but we all did. And it probably took us 6 to 12 months, but we just kept going on about, oh, wouldn't it be great to have strategy? We really should do a strategy session. Oh, if we had a strategy, then blah, blah, blah. We'd be able to get ourselves out of this situation we're in. So we just very gently, I mean, it sounds like it wasn't gentle, but we very gently brought that person along to a position which was, hey, the rest of us want to do strategy, so we're going to do strategy. And he did. And we did strategy, and then the company ended up doing well and pulling itself out of the trouble it was in. So that's one way of doing it. In the other situation I was in, I actually gave up, which sounds terrible from the perspective of someone who says it doesn't do no. I did a no, which was no, this is not going anywhere. And I can see this will go nowhere, so I'm going to have to go. And so that was a situation where I was not able to help the person in leadership see that strategy was needed. In other examples where, say, for instance, you've got a CEO who's not being as strategic as you'd like them to be, my experience there has been that they actually just needed permission and space to be more strategic. So we as a board just needed to encourage that person to be more strategic and to see their strategic thinking. And they're great and wonderful strategic thinkers. And now that's coming out, and we can see that taking place within our board. So as a board, I think you can have that that role to give permission and to encourage the CEO to be strategic. If they're in my team, I mean, you're right, I never forget doing that, you know, is it JMPS? I don't know what it is, you know, any of the four quadrants of where you sit, and being really surprised that as a physicist, I didn't sit in that detailed square. But it was really interesting because I used to find those people so frustrating because I'm out here doing the visionary thing and then, yeah, we're going here, you know, and they're doing the, oh yes, but we just need to get this number right here. But as I grew in my leadership experience, I now value those people so much because they can do what I cannot, or what I can do, I just don't want to do it. And so I really began to see the value. So I would say, to another part to your question is, not everybody has to be visionary, not everybody has to be strategic. In fact, it'd be a disaster if we all were, but recognize the people who aren't and use their skills in the areas that they'd be useful. I mean, for instance, you need data for strategy. So if you've got people who are really in the weeds, that's great. Get them to extract stuff from the weeds that you can then use.
Absolutely. And, you know, we in organizations, we talk a lot about diversity and equity and inclusion. And yet, as I wander around different organizations, I see varying degrees of understanding and application of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think the example that you've just given there is a very practical way of understanding that what I can do, you can't, and what you can do, I can't, but together we're unbeatable.
Exactly.
And to be able to recognize that. Sarah, I wonder if we could just take the conversation in a slightly different direction. Something that you've touched on a few times that I'd like to go back to is this notion of innovation. And a couple of things I wouldn't mind your thoughts on. I recall reading an Australian Institute of Company Directors article recently, and the notion of the article was, if you've got a person in your organization who is delegated for innovation, then you've already lost the plot. Innovation should be part of the culture, like our values, like freedom. It shouldn't be delegated to one person or one little department or something like that. And that was the idea of the article that was talking about innovation is everybody's business, and this is the world we live in. The flip side of innovation sometimes is disruption, and you know, leadership in a disruptive world. So I'm interested in your view. What are your disruptions? What disruptions are you seeing coming down the line, be they technological or economic or political or social, whatever those disruptions might be? And how do we create a culture of innovation to be able to manage our way through some of these disruptions without necessarily saying, oh, we have an innovation person, so therefore we'll delegate it all to them? Your thoughts?
Well, firstly, I'd say you can't be what you can't see. So if you can't see innovation in your organization, you can't be it. So I actually think you do need people who are responsible for innovation to start with. And you need to demonstrate what that is. I remember, I never forget when we set up Open Innovation at Cadbury, I looked up to see what people are writing about in terms of change. So, you know, how do you drive change? And the most compelling piece that I saw said you have to drive change by demonstrating results. You can't promise results and expect people to just believe you. You need to demonstrate results. So I'm a firm believer that you do actually need a group of people, even if it's under the radar, doing some of the innovation work, the disruptive work, to demonstrate what that means for the business, what that means for the humans in the business. The yes. best thing that then can happen is that you actually, well, this is what happened at Cadbury. We built up a team that then worked with the rest of our of the organization to help them with innovation. And before we knew it, everyone was doing innovation. I mean, I'm exaggerating, it wasn't everybody, but it had filtered through, the culture had filtered through. I think if you have a team that can demonstrate results, show the business what that's going to mean for them, so they can see why they bother, before you know it, everyone's doing it and it's gone across across your organization.
Yes, yes. So starting with a person, a small group of people, but then using that to create the culture of innovation across the organization, but having that central point where it is generated, started, driven, excelled from that point, but not only stopping there, but using it to drive the culture across the organization. Is that your key point there?
Yes, and the results. You have to show results.
Yes, absolutely.
You have to show how people can achieve what they're trying to achieve.
Sarah, clearly for you, it's all about the people, which is the way it should be. So let's circle, let's finish with one last line of inquiry and circle all the way back to the beginning of our conversation when you were discussing collective leadership. In the context, I think it was Canberra Innovation, where you were leading the growth of a community. That community did not report to you. That community, they were represented different organisations. It was up to you to inspire them and take them on the journey in a collective way. How do you do that? How do you take people who can say at a moment's notice, actually, I don't need to be part of this conversation, I'm out of here. How do you take them on that journey?
I'd like to expand that beyond even just that community, because it's the same on a board. Like, no one on a board has to do anything that some person on the board says. You actually have to bring a whole board along, whether you're the chair or not the chair. So that's the first thing I'd like to say. It's not just in terms of the community. There's plenty of people you have no power over, that you try to help them to do things that you think will be good for them and could be the outcome you're trying to drive. I think the first thing is having a big hairy audacious goal, something that people can look at and go, I would like to be part of that. That future that you're talking about, that outcome that you're talking about, I want to be part of that. So I think that's the first thing. You find something that you know energizes you, something you know would make a big difference and that people can hook their emotions onto and can join into from an emotional perspective. Then making sure that they can see it's doable and it's possible. So again, I said, you know, you start change by giving actual outcomes and people seeing results. So making sure people early on can see results that are leading towards the goal that you're trying to go for. And then I think one of the most important things is making sure people realize it's them that's doing it. It's actually not you. I think the biggest mistake people make as leaders when they're trying to lead collectively is making it about themselves. So put your ego on the side. You need a bit of ego because you're a leader and egos need ego to energize them. But put most of it to the side and make sure that you are making it really clear this is about other people and what other people can do, how other people can be seen, how other people can find their place, how other people can bring their skills and their personality and their humanness to the table to achieve this incredible goal and this outcome that they have linked into and bought into with you.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well said, Sarah.
Thank you. Thanks, Darryl. With a croaky.
Well, Sarah, your croaky voice may not hold out much longer, and we're just about out of time. So that's probably a great moment to wrap up. This has been a fantastic conversation, and the insights that you've given us and the listeners in so many different ways. There's so much food for thought there. You've given me a lot of food for thought. So from me personally, thank you so much. And on behalf of the listeners, thanks, Sarah Pearson.